Anthony Lerman is a British writer who focuses on issues including such as Israel-Palestine, Middle Eastern politics, anti-Semitism, racism, Jewish life in Europe, global Jewish politics, multiculturalism, and religion in public life. He's the author of The Making and Unmaking of the Zionist, A Personal and Political Journey, which was published in 2012. His articles frequently appear in the New York Times, The Independent, The Guardian, and Haaretz, among many other publications, and he was a founding director of the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, a think tank that examines social, political, and cultural problems facing Jews and other minorities in Europe. And he sits on the board of various European nonprofits. As founding chief executive of the Rothschild Foundation Europe from 1999 to 2006, a major philanthropy supporting Jewish life in Europe, he was instrumental in facilitating the revival of Jewish life across the continent. He was the editor of Patterns of Prejudice, an international academic journal on racism and anti-Semitism, and a founding general editor of Anti-Semitism World Report. He's an honorary fellow at the Parks Institute for the Study of Jewish and Non-Jewish Relations, and he also works closely with the Bruno Kielski Forum for International Dialogue on Vienna on Senses of Belonging in Europe, and he's a member of the forum's Arab and Jewish Engagements Group. Clearly, Mr. Lerman is a terrific mind and an active thinker, and it's such a pleasure to have you here at the Boisy Center. Welcome.
Thank you very much indeed, Eric, and thank you, and thank Alan. I want to thank Alan in particular for making this possible for me to come here and talk to you this afternoon, this evening, about this about the subject. It's a real pleasure. I've been in America for a few days. I came from Chicago this morning, I'm going on to Baltimore in a couple of days' time, back to England. On Sunday, a whirlwind kind of tour, but it's really been interesting so far, and I'm sure it's going to be interesting this evening. So let me get started straight away and say that I think the best way of opening a discussion about what's been called the new paradigm is to take as a starting point the document entitled The Principles of Israeli-Jewish-Palestinian Partnership, produced by the members of the Alternatives to Partition Group that met in Vienna in 2011 and 2012 under the auspices of the Bruno Kreisky Forum for International Dialogue. Now, this was a varied group of Israeli Jews and Palestinians from inside Israel, Jerusalem, the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and the diaspora. And they held a series of confidential discussions which resulted in the issuing of a principles document in October 2012. Their first public presentation of the results of their discussions was directed largely at members of the European Parliament, and it took place at the Brussels Parliament Building in November 2013. Now, after I briefly summarise this very short document, actually it's only a two-page document that they produced, I'll run through the critique of the current statist stroke partition paradigm and status quo that underpins the document, and then I'll expand on the key principles of the equal rights agenda. And finally, I'll look at the issue of how pursuing that agenda might work in practice, at the same time focusing on some of the challenges that the equal rights agenda faces. I should make it clear from the outset that I, although, as Eric said, I'm associated with the Kreisky Forum for International Dialogue in Vienna and have been since 2012 working on this project on belonging in Europe. I wasn't a member of this Alternatives to Partition group. I only learned of its work after the principles document was made public. But in 2011, I argued in my book, Eric mentioned that, and quoting from my book, the dominant political and religious forces in Israel clearly reject the two states for two peoples, land for peace formula that held sway during the period of the Oslo Accords. Israel's relations with the Palestinians and its other neighbours have been relegated to the status of a regional problem to be managed, not resolved. The struggle for Palestinian rights, I wrote, for a peace with justice may well be forced to shift to fighting for equality, citizenship, democracy, and human rights within the de facto one-state framework since the possibility of anything other than a Bantustan-type Palestinian entity or entities will be out of the question. And I concluded, is it possible to see this as the beginning of a new road rather than the end of all hopes for Palestinian self-determination? So having already expressed such a view, I was very encouraged to see how far the Alternatives to Partition group had come in developing the focus on equal rights into a set of complementary and comprehensive principles. In the document that I now summarise, part quoting, part paraphrasing, the principles are preceded by an explanation for the decision to pave this new path to shift to this new paradigm. So, the document, as I say, part quoting, part paraphrasing, the political impasse provides neither freedom nor dignity for the Palestinians, nor satisfies the security concerns of Israeli Jews and Palestinians. No viable and just two-state solution is close. A de facto single regime of Israeli domination and discrimination prevails. To achieve historical reconciliation and constructive normative and political engagement, it's urgent to depart from the current paradigm of solutions based primarily or exclusively on the logic of partition and wrenching separation as manifested in skewed power relations and interests rather than symmetrical rights and evident needs. The principles, the group believes, would secure the individual and collective rights, including national self-determination, interests and identities of Jewish Israelis and Palestinians alike. The group stressed that they are confronting the unavoidable empirical reality of the growing intertwinement of lives, rights and identities of Palestinians and Jews, as well as factual developments, such as Israel's ongoing colonial expansionist project in East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and the southern Negev. Their initiative, that's the initiative of this group, is grounded on the premises of justice, e.g. the Palestinian refugee problem, refraining from inflicting injustices on the agents of a previous injustice, and on an inclusive and egalitarian notion of democracy. No governmental or institutional formula for ending the conflict is either named or implied in this document. The principles can be accommodated in various constitutional and or institutional arrangements and transcend the binary predicament of one state, two states as the preordaining principle of a political solution since it has been rendered factually and empirically obsolete. The principles provide the basis for a different understanding of the possibilities and actualities for a just and durable solution in Israel-Palestine. In brief, the guiding principles are, and there's just five of them, every resident or person holding resident status between the Jordan and the Mediterranean will be granted equal individual, political, economic, and social rights. Two, the collective rights of Israeli Jews and Palestinians, linguistic, cultural, religious, and political, will be guaranteed in any political framework. Neither will solely have any exclusive sovereignty over the entire land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. Three, the abolition of all exclusive Jewish privileges. All resources will be distributed based on restorative and distributive justice principles. Four, recognition of the Palestinian right of return as embodied in UN Resolution 194. Implementation will take into account the reality on the ground, such that righting the moral and political injustice of Palestinian dispossession should not be effected by means of new injustice. And finally, five, Jews and Palestinians living in the diaspora will be able to receive immunity if in danger and be given privileged immigration status compared to any other ethnic and national group. Otherwise, new political institutions will legislate democratic immigration laws to regulate citizenship. So that's the document. Turning to what underpins it in terms of their critique of the current situation. So, to a group of interested and informed observers here in Boston or in London, granting equal rights as part of any just solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict may sound obvious, axiomatic even. It's a principle I think you take for granted here, as we do in the UK, even though we in the UK have no written constitution as such. Principle is one thing, however, ensuring equal rights in practice, even in our own societies, is something else. I would argue that equal rights culture has never been strong in Israel, Palestine. But awareness of the rights deficit has clearly grown. Witness the many Israeli and Palestinian NGOs now devoted to monitoring and campaigning on rights issues. Yet the pressure from right-wing political parties and civil society groups in Israel to institutionalize restrictions on the rights of certain groups and individuals has also increased. Some veteran campaigners for Israel-Palestine peace and reconciliation have argued that they have always been seeking equal rights for all. So what's new about proclaiming this as the quote-unquote new paradigm now? But while giving due deference to the commitment to rights among such people, the fact is that the dominant narrative and action around peace has been about land, territory, state, and ownership, etc. In short, about partition. It was assumed that rights would be granted as a result of agreement on such arrangements. Primacy was given to protecting the Jewish and Palestinian nations, or concepts of the Jewish and Palestinian nations, furthering their interests as perceived homogeneous groups, not to the more complex but fundamental issue of rights. Reaching the conclusion that negotiating over statist partition arrangements as the path to resolving the conflict has failed is a major driver of the new paradigm. Now, for many people, this has simply been a recognition of reality in two respects. First, the collapse of the peace talks brokered by Secretary of State Kerry was seen as the final fading of what remained of the Oslo process and the death knell for the two-state solution. Not that Oslo was necessarily entirely without merit. Mutual recognition of the collective rights of Palestinians and Israelis, which was part of it, was revolutionary, writes Professor Leila Farsakh of the University of Massachusetts here in Boston. But not only did it not deliver a result, it had structural and principal faults from the start. Second, while talks about two states continued, everything was being done to discredit any talk of the one state idea, that was constantly dismissed as fantasy or worse, on the ground, a one-state reality had long been emerging and its existence could no longer be ignored. There is today one single sovereign entity under Israeli political, military and economic dominion between the Jordan and the Mediterranean, in which there are two or three levels of citizenship or non-citizenship. This means that Palestinians and Israeli Jews are living together in a reality of spatial and binational heterogeneity, jeopardizing the two nation states for two peoples recipe, since this is based on national homogeneity and demographic separation. Beyond these realities, critics find the existing paradigm riddled with fundamental structural problems and based on unsustainable principles. For example, it assumes the existence of two equal partners freely negotiating over how to achieve a permanent peace, when, in fact, this is a false symmetry, as the disparities in power and influence of the two parties are legion. In effect, the granting of national self-determination, rights, resources, borders, was framed as if it was some kind of gift, almost entirely in the hands of the Israelis to bestow or not. Then it takes 1967 as the historical starting point for negotiations, when it's the consequences of the 1948 war that have to be acknowledged and confronted. Third, Oslo was never backed by any international legal instrument. So the Palestinians had no means to call Israel to account for the ongoing drive to create new and expand existing settlements, illegal under international law. Fourth, the process actually never promised a Palestinian state, nor did it end the occupation. It simply redefined it, bypassing the burning issues of settlements, borders, territory, and refugees. And finally, although Oslo allowed the establishment of limited Palestinian autonomy over less than 22% of the West Bank, and a Palestinian authority with functional jurisdiction but no sovereignty over 93% of the Palestinian people. The weaknesses in this arrangement throw into doubt the very notion that partition and an exclusive independent nation state is the way to secure rights. Now, this questioning of the nation state, widely seen as an entity weakened by globalization, as the bedrock for granting and guaranteeing rights, understandably impinges on how both Palestinians and Israeli Jews perceive their nationalisms. The Jewish side has the comfort of rethinking Zionism from a position of having already secured the fundamental aim of the Zionist movement, the creation of a state. But even Zionist historians of Zionism acknowledge that this did not result in the normalization of the Jewish people, one of the fundamental aims of Zionism, nor did it eradicate anti-Semitism, guarantee a Jewish majority in perpetuity, or fulfill other fundamental aims of Zionism. And it failed to expunge the Palestinian experience from history. Moreover, the only Zionist ideological project remaining is the settler colonial religious messianic ethno-nationalist Zionism of the dominant right wing and far right political forces in Israel. For the Palestinians, the statist enterprise, focused almost entirely on the West Bank, has become hegemonic and tyrannical, writes Bashir Bashir of the Van Leer Jerusalem Institute, a barrier to articulating the Palestinian national cause. But Israeli settlement policy and the demand that Palestinians recognize Israel as the Jewish state have brought the Nakba, the Palestinian refugees, and the Palestinian minority in Israel back into the frame, since the rights of all Palestinians are affected. So Palestinian nationalism, according to Bashir, is undergoing a, quote, gradual shift from an exclusively state-oriented politics to a rights-based politics, focusing on the inalienable and basic individual and national rights, regardless of the exact institutional frame, i.e. one state, federation, confederation, etc., within which these rights and aspirations would be realized. And since everyone is entitled to the same rights, a serious engagement with Israeli Jews and their rights is a core challenge for those redefining Palestinian nationalism. Now, it'd be wrong entirely to assume that the shift in Palestinian thinking towards embracing the equal rights paradigm implies some tacit acceptance of occupation. Rather, that it is intolerable to delay Palestinians claiming their rights until a politically sufficient settlement comes along, especially given that no such settlement has emerged after 48 years and none looks likely to emerge in the near future. And that ultimately, the equal rights agenda can never be fully realized until occupation is brought to an end. The fact is that occupation is not a static phenomenon, but a dynamic project of Israeli-Jewish ethno-national self-realization. And for Palestinians, it's the living embodiment of the stark truth that the Nakba was not something that occurred in 1948 and is now simply history, but is a continuing process. It hasn't come to an end. The Israeli Jews and the Palestinians involved in the alternatives to partition discussions all accept this and see the principles as the path towards ending it, because they do not make the mistake of prioritizing state-based solutions over the attainment of equal rights. Edward Said's demand, "equality or nothing," is often quoted. Now, to expand a little bit on the key principles, they may seem a bit terse when you read the document, but they're derived from some far-reaching conclusions based on much debate and analysis, and I would highlight a few things. First of all, binationalism. Despite the years of emphasis on partition, separation, division of the land, the unilateral withdrawal from Sinai and the building of the wall, which was supposed to take separation to its logical extreme, The result of occupation settlements and the subservient role played by the Palestinian Authority in managing Israel's security interests in the West Bank has only served to emphasize the extent to which Israeli and Palestinian fates are intertwined. Bashir speaks of this, from the Palestinians' perspective, as, quote, colonial binational realities. But he and his colleagues turn this negative into a positive on the grounds that, deprived of its colonial aspects, binationalism simply reflects the fact that from the Jordan to the Mediterranean, it's a binational land. Within the borders of pre-67 Israel, despite the attempts of successive governments to ignore and suppress it, a binational reality has always prevailed, emphasizes Associate Professor at the Hebrew University in Baal Arnon. And in recent years, as Arabs in Israel have increasingly come to see themselves as Palestinians, this reality has become more pronounced. Binationalism, argues Dmitry Shumsky, also at the Hebrew University, doesn't mean binational state. But there can be no division into two states, if this were the ultimately agreed constitutional option, unless binationalism is accepted as both a reality and a positive value. Bashir speaks of, quote, adopting binational ethics leading to historical reconciliation, end quote. Two peoples living in a shared space with both peoples using the same map of their homeland. Two peoples sharing sovereign rights. So on the question of shared sovereignty, this notion of shared sovereignty is of fundamental importance because it helps in contradicting the statist logic that has dominated peace discussions for decades. It's true that sovereign states can be powerful and crucial institutional frameworks for shaping political options, the distribution of resources and people's individual and collective rights, but there's no guarantee that such a state won't discriminate unfairly and institutionalize inequality. From the Palestinians' perspective, Israeli state sovereignty has become the organizing principle for imposed oppression, making an alternative notion of sovereignty essential. Now, the Alternatives to Partition group see the EU as a model here. Bashir argues that the EU breaks from the Westphalian notion of absolute state sovereignty by making sovereignty shared and divisible, and has made such an arrangement work, kind of more or less. Moreover, the EU, Farsak argues, quote, shows that self-determination can exist in different configurations by first recognizing national and individual rights in a unified state of rights, end quote. The statist separation process has undermined the principle of two viable states, sanctioned the master-slave relationship implied in Israel's self-appellation as the Jewish state, denying the minority 20% any say in the matter, and introduced a built-in systematic structural asymmetry of power that's hard to break. A post-Westphalian approach to self-determination for both sides will be grounded in the principles of equality, reciprocity, and mutual legitimacy, which for Palestinians means coming to terms with Israeli Jewish nationalism and recognizing the Jews' acquired right to national self-determination and vice versa. Turning to the equal rights vocabulary, if you look at the vocabulary of the rights-based new paradigm in isolation, it can seem perhaps somewhat romantic and utopian. But it actually implies hard choices in terms of dismantling discriminatory structures, compromise, and overcoming cherished historical positions. Leila Farzak's summary of what the rights-based approach is, why the time is right for equal rights for all, covers the ground. She says it's ethical, injustice is not remedied by more oppression, it's realistic, it doesn't negate history nor aspire to the unattainable, it's principled, the individual and collective rights of Palestinians and Israelis are recognized with no precedence given to one over the other, it's not territorially bound, prioritizes rights over questions of territorial sovereignty, and it protects the rights of Palestinians and Israelis to self-determination based on a democratic and inclusive polity. In practice, implementation would mean dismantling Israeli Jewish privileges, redistributing resources based on restorative and reparative justice, respecting and realizing the rights of Palestinian refugees to return, assuming responsibility for the Nakba and offering an apology. Were a state of rights to emerge in which the individual, collective, and national rights of all who live between the Jordan and the Mediterranean are guaranteed, it will be characterized by multinational democracy, joint ownership, coexistence, integration, equality, reciprocity, respect, and human dignity. Okay, finally, turning to how this might work in practice and some of the challenges that are thrown up by these ideas. Now, for an initiative that puts rights first and deliberately avoids any substantive discussion about the preferred institutional or constitutional arrangements, it's not surprising that there are a few clues as to how a state of rights would be reached. Rafe Zreik of Tel Aviv University argued that although Palestinians may well achieve their basic national rights within the frame of either the two or the one state solution, the better option would be through, quote, a discourse that reframes the questions and open-mindedly approaches the solutions, guided by principles and values that are based on by nationalism, equality, and freedom. Ultimately, Zreik continues, this alternative conversation will bear solutions. It will be a conversation that opens itself up to the past without living in it. The Palestinians want to end the occupation, but not necessarily by surgical land division, if this severely compromises their political and historical individual and collective rights. So how to get from the current oppressive one-state reality to this binational self-determination, multinational democracy, shared sovereignty, and guaranteed rights for all? Well, one idea, obviously, is you have to build support for this idea. And this group is clearly targeting European policymakers, trying to woo them away from absolute commitment to the primacy of the two-state solution. But a much wider basis of support among Israelis and Palestinians, achieved through argument and persuasion, would be necessary. And although the dearth of other ideas suggests an opening for the equal rights paradigm, the deep disillusionment that has set in recent years makes the task of convincing others very difficult. Most dovish Israeli politicians, and there aren't many of those at the moment, insofar as they see the occupation and Palestinian rights as of any importance at all, are wedded to the two-state solution. And while some very senior Palestinian figures have been involved in discussions about the new paradigm, the PA's fortunes are so tightly bound up with Israeli priorities that their two statist solutions remain paramount. Another way forward might be, or should be, a joint Palestinian-Israeli-Jewish political campaign. Since the far-reaching ideas would have an impact on every individual in Israel-Palestine, it seems obvious that a grassroots campaign would be essential. The discourse so firmly emphasizes democratic participation and decision-making, equality, respect, and therefore implies empowerment at the grassroots level, also strongly criticizing the power and dignity imbalance where all talk is of Israel or outside parties giving rights to the Palestinians, allowing them to do this or that. You would imagine that such a campaign being driven by the desire to claim the rights to which people are entitled, auto-emancipation, if you like, not a gift bestowed by external powers. Yet this question actually is not really addressed in the material that's been produced so far by this group. One key figure on the Palestinian side, Hussam Zonlot, Fatah's executive deputy commissioner for foreign relations, who participated in discussions at the European Parliament and clearly strongly sympathized with the rights agenda, argued strongly that the two sides must not be left to sort things out on their own. So, in a sense, opening the door again for external actors like the United States and the EU to, I don't know, impose a solution based on these ideas. Another issue raised by these ideas is quite obviously, how would equal rights be guaranteed without state backing? Now, it's axiomatic that any equal rights campaign would have to be non-violent. But progress will only be made by legal changes, enshrining rights in law, giving all Palestinians the right to vote, not for fictional or ersatz authorities, but for those who truly have dominion over their lives, allowing them the political representation in that authority, and so on. But who would be appealed to make these changes? Hard to know. In the current reality, it looks as if these would have to be Israeli institutions. One might envisage the Israeli Supreme Court playing a major part here. It has shown itself to have an independence of mind on some things in the past. But it's been conflicted about Palestinian rights as well. So there's no guarantee that it would provide the pathway to equal rights. But there is a bigger question. Were a joint Israeli-Palestinian campaign to take this route, would it not mean the West Bank Palestinians accepting the one-state reality in too formal a sense, with no guarantee that the regime of privileges for Jews would ever be dismantled? The statist obsession might well have contributed to the impasse, the continuation of the Nakba, but how would a guarantee of equal rights be secured without state backing? A different departure point is suggested in some of the material, might be through the United Nations. Leila Farsak suggests that, quote, just as UN resolutions 181 and 242 form the international legal basis for a two-state solution, a new UN resolution could create the legal foundation for a state for all its citizens, be it a binational or a confederate state. And the EU could be instrumental in getting such a resolution passed, she suggests. And finally, to come back to binationalism again, given that most people are likely to think that binationalism died with the demise of the group Brit Shalom in Palestine in the 1930s, of what people like Martin Buber and Yehuda Magnus were members of and founders of, that idea died then, also completely after the founding of the Unitary State of Israel. The reconsideration of binationalism as a suitable characterization of the intertwining of Palestinians and Israeli Jews throughout Israel-Palestine and its treatment by this group as a positive value, indeed a core principle of the equal rights paradigm, is perhaps surprising, but I would suggest nonetheless, for me anyway, convincing. However, the Alternatives to Partition group are aware that it's a challenging concept for both Palestinians and Israelis. For the former, squaring this with the Palestinians' traditional relationship with Arab nationalism is problematic. Furthermore, some definitions of Palestinian identity, as expressed in, for example, political Islam, or the strongly held view that Zionism is nothing more than a colonial movement, might not be compatible with this notion of binational ethics. And as for Israelis, the Zionist mainstream has moved in an ever more exclusivist direction in recent years, increasingly dismissive of the legitimacy of Palestinian national identity. There's no recognition of the national rights of the Palestinians within Israel, in Israel's basic law. And in the current climate, no prospect at all of that changing. It's hard to see how a polity so wedded to an exclusivist national identity, however mythical, could voluntarily embrace binationalism as a positive choice. Addressing whether binationalism could be theoretically valid and empirically viable, the scholar of binationalism at Princeton and Tel Aviv University, Uriel Abulof, concludes that in the case of Israel-Palestine, it doesn't work. He argues that given that there is no love, no habitus, no moral imperative, no compelling narrative, legitimating binationalism's essential we belong together imperative in the Israel-Palestine case is not possible. I'm not sure he's right, but clearly, as I believe the Alternative to Partition group are well aware, as with much else in the Equal Rights Initiative, there is still much to discuss.
Thank you.